Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and it is content. This is probably the year where we're going to lay down the actual, I'll call it the hard curriculum content. In other words, over the past, since 2013 when I started doing this and covering content, I mean, my focus was really Republic Review, the solution. But I realized that there were so many people that were caught up on, you know, the 14th Amendment and sovereign citizen and the convention. And anyway, we kind of covered this on the first. The point is that we've, over time, as people have kind of said, well, why are you doing this? You know, actually providing the history and the timeline to help everybody see this is how it's all evolved. This is how we actually came to be as a nation. This is how we evolved into our constitutional hybrid republic. Now, the point before we get into everything else, because again, you know, that debt is fraud, it's now or never, you know, and it's all about focus on the Constitution. The point regarding this evolution, when these men went into the Constitutional Convention, these delegates from the states, they had these ideas. But what they ended up producing was well beyond what any one of them could have fathomed. And how this Constitution came to be was not an evolution. In other words, if it was an evolution, it probably would have taken years with amendments to get to where it needed to be, where it was when they were done. In other words, because they prostrated themselves, because they had the opportunity of peace to actually receive supplication, to understand what they needed to do, there's no doubt in my mind that we had a huge leap forward in that short 4+ month period of time when these men were in convention to create this Constitution. In other words, the divine hand of providence was literally wreaking havoc in Pennsylvania and, you know, getting these minds and these men to work together into creating a document that it has taken centuries to us to finally start realizing some of these things that many of the men didn't. Now, Madison, being probably the father and the guy that actually had the plan, you know, the initial plan, was probably the one that was kind of keeping track. And that was probably just due to the fact that he was the author of the first plan. As he presented the plan to the delegates of Virginia before it went to the convention, he had it really well in his mind what he wanted to see done. Then the doors in heaven, the doors and windows of heaven were opened upon him and them, and all of a sudden, many of these things started coming together to where there's no doubt in my mind where Madison acknowledged and saw these changes, why he was so adamant in supporting the Constitution as it was defined by the ratification debate. So, anyway, as we kind of wrapped up yesterday, we didn't really have time, but I did ask Sean at this point how we kind of came to this timeline of from the Magna Carta into, you know, the Tory Acts. We haven't even hit the Articles of Assembly, or I should say the Articles of Association yet, the true document that was created before this. The reason we're using this first is one of you yesterday was, or actually the previous show was the January 2nd. Today is Monday. So anyway, because this is January 5th, it's the following day and following show, we want to kind of keep going. And so the reason why I always use January 2nd was because that big Tory Act was a January 2nd day. And it was the beginning of this movement in America that basically became galvanized from that point. This is when they started realizing that this was not just some little quip, you know, of going out and capturing all the bad people and everything would work out. they realized that they had a PR campaign. They had a lot to do before they could really move forward into independence. They, at this point in time, they weren't even sure. But anyway, so as I asked you in the last show, you know, you said you really didn't have anything, but then you did, because, you know, I think you're kind of articulating how this all, you know, lays out. It starts to make sense. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that I was talking about how the tenor of their
of the tone
disagreement changed when they realized that the king was not gonna use diplomacy to address their claims. When he sent the troops, then they realized that they'd better take it seriously and do things in a way, like you were saying, to get the backing and support of the people in the colonies. Because, I mean, you think about it, they're on shaky ground, because if the king comes down too hard on the colonies and the people start really suffering because of what these men were doing, that's one way to squeeze that spirit out of people, you know, is to make life hard for them.
Right. Now, let me
also... So it's a PR campaign, like you were talking
about. Absolutely. Let me also point out, because I think where we left off was with the green text. Now we're going to get into the unhighlighted text. But they start really talking about this duty to God in this next part here, duty to the Creator. I really harp on the importance of our duty as U.S. citizens, as Christians. Our duty is to defend that Constitution which he gave us. And that's one of the reasons why the oath of the citizenship is the way it is. These men realized what they ended up getting, and they realized, you know, some of the things that they needed to do. The only thing that they didn't realize was how corrupt and how easy this nation would become corrupt. That by the Civil War, that actually broke, you know, I'll just say the camel's back, when we realized how corrupt everything was happening around them, with the 14th Amendment putting teeth into the Constitution for the first time that said, hey, if you're going to violate your oath of office, then you can never be a public servant anymore. From this point of your violation on, you're out, you're gone, and you're banished. So, anyway, let's go ahead and pick up where we left off with respect to all such unworthy Americans. Go ahead.
And with respect to all such unworthy Americans, as regardless of their duty to their Creator, their country, and their posterity, have taken part with our oppressors, and influenced by the hope or possession of ignominious rewards, strive to recommend themselves to the bounty of administration by misrepresenting and traducing the conduct of people and principles of the Friends of American Liberty, and opposing every measure formed for its preservation and security. Resolved that it be recommended to different assemblies, conventions, and committees or councils of safety in the United Colonies by the most speedy and effectual measures to frustrate the mischievous machinations and restrain the wicked practices of these men. And it is the opinion of this Congress that they ought to be disarmed, and the more dangerous among them either kept in safe custody or bound with sufficient sureties to their good behavior. Okay, and in order that said assemblies, conventions, committees, or councils of safety may be enabled with greater ease and facility to carry this resolution into execution, resolved that they be authorized to call to their aid whatever continental troops stationed in or near their respective colonies may be conveniently spared from their more immediate duty, and the commanding officers of such troops are hereby directed to afford the said assemblies, conventions, committees of councils, or councils of safety all such assistance in executing this resolution as they may require, and which, consistent with the good of the service, may be supplied.
Okay, so as they kind of, you know, identified the atrocities of these unworthy Americans, that the most scrupulous, or I should say, those who had no scruples, those who, you know, were literally supporting and harming the cause of liberty, that they needed to arrest these men, that they needed to identify them and, you know, separate them, disarm them, whatever they needed to do. And so they still wanted that to happen, but not to go out and arrest everybody, just the big threats that they wanted. And they, and here's where they actually gave them the insight that if this be the case, to go ahead and bring in the militia to do this so that they can be seized with a level of authority as well as force to basically compel them to go with them into safekeeping, because they wanted to keep them safe in custody. Because this became a long war, this was not something that was just like flipping a switch and it's over. This became a long war. And I don't have, because I don't do the macro, or I should say, I don't do micro dives on the history, because that becomes so consuming that you end up really knowing a lot of things about one little event instead of knowing a lot of things about all the events. And so there probably is somebody that really, because the American Revolution has been documented ad nauseum, and I'm sure that there's probably a really good documentation on, you know, these people that were put into custody, were they broken free? Because the British started roaming throughout most of the colonies, you know, basically wreaking havoc. This was when they finally realized that they just didn't have enough resources in the British Empire to bring the amount of force necessary to basically quell this rebellion or this revolution and sustain that type of force to do that. We're talking about, you know, millions of people to try to control them. There were more people here than I believe that were actually in Britain, that were, you know, the citizens of Britain. So it was kind of problematic. Anyway, let's keep going to finish this one up.
Resolved that all the detachments of Continental troops which may be ordered on the business in the foregoing resolution mentioned be, while so employed, under direction and control of the assemblies, conventions, committees, or councils of safety aforesaid. Resolved that it be recommended to all the United Colonies to aid each other on request from their respective assemblies, conventions, committees, or councils of safety and county committees on every emergency, and to cultivate, cherish, and increase the present happy and necessary union by continual interchange of mutual good offices. And whereas the execrable barbarity with which this unhappy war has been conducted on the part of our enemies, such as burning our defenseless towns and villages, exposing their inhabitants without regard to sex or age to all the miseries which loss of property, the rigor of the season, and inhuman devastation can inflict, exciting domestic insurrections and murders, bribing the savages to desolate our frontiers, and casting such of us as the fortune of war has put into their power into gaols there to be languished in irons and want, compelling the inhabitants of Boston, in violation of the treaty, to remain confined within the town, exposed to the insolence of the soldiery and other enormities, as the mention of which decency and humanity will forever blush, may justly provoke the inhabitants of these colonies to retaliation. Resolved that it be recommended to them to continue mindful that humanity ought to distinguish the brave, that cruelty should find no admission among a free people, and to take care that no page in the annals of America be stained by a recital of any action which justice or Christianity may condemn, and to rest assured that whenever retaliation may be necessary or tend to their security, this Congress will undertake the disagreeable task. Resolved that the assemblies, conventions, or committees, or councils of safety be requested forthwith to transmit to this Congress copies of all petitions, memorials, and remonstrances which have been by their respective colleagues presented to the throne or either House of Parliament since the year 1762, and that they also inform this Congress whether any and what answers were given to them.
Okay, so now they're doing a data call, but even before that, they basically kind of talked about, you know, this group of people that would be, you know, less favorable or less savory in, you know, what was going on with this. The cause of liberty was a very sacred process. At least this is how these men looked at this. They didn't want to go to war. They wanted to enjoy liberty. They were happy living under the monarchical theocracy of Britain. They had been asking and pleading. To this point, the king had his chance to correct his business decision and say, you know what, we're going to give you access. I can't believe that the king had really good strategic head in looking at what it was going to take to quell, or either that or he had really bad intelligence. I mean, he was probably being told, oh, there's just a few, you know, naysayers out there that, you know, we can easily suppress that. But as things started to unfurl, and as a matter of fact, as Washington ended up getting out of Back Bay and getting out of the Boston area, kind of, not necessarily unscathed, but, you know, as unscathed that he was, really proved that Britain, you know, needed to be far more serious and be more committed with the troops and resources necessary to basically stop this ragtag little, you know, revolutionary force of these militias that they were dealing with. I mean, they really underestimated, you know, what these militias were what the militia was capable of doing. But again, we even changed the warfare, the tactics, and all of that. So anyway, any comments of what you read so far and going up to this data call?
No, sir.
Okay. So now they requested that the provincial governments send to them their petitions and the information that they had received or what answers given to them. Now, in March 14th, let's go ahead and read this one. Now, this is just a couple months later. Go ahead.
March 14th.
Yeah, the next one down.
Oh, okay. I was a little past it.
That's okay.
All right. Resolved that it be recommended to the several assemblies, conventions, and councils or committees of safety of the United Colonies immediately to cause all persons to be disarmed within their respective colonies who are notoriously disaffected to the cause of America or who have not associated and shall refuse to associate to defend by arms these United Colonies against the hostile attempts of the British fleets and armies, and to oblige the arms taken from such persons in each respective colony, in the first place to the arming of the Continental troops raised in said colony, in the next to the arming such troops as are raised by the colony for its own defense, and the residue to be applied to the arming the associators, that the arms when taken be appraised by indifferent persons and such as are applied to the arming the Continental troops be paid for by Congress and the residue by the respective assemblies, conventions, or councils, or committees of safety.
Okay, so as we kind of look at this, one of the things that I, you know, want to kind of pop, you know, reach into this little rabbit hole and kind of pull out and pop this idea out. We're actually looking at how they dealt with dissenters. And as a matter of fact, here's the question I have. Being men that believed in the freedom of speech, being men at the time believing based on the glorious Bill of Rights, this freedom of expression, this freedom of religion, and the freedom of dissent, how much freedom or how much tolerance did they have now with people that they really perceived as a threat?
Not much.
Not much at all. Okay, so when you realize that you now have a group of people whose ideology is totally antithetical, 180 out from our prevailing thought of the of and the prevailing ideology of our nation. In other words, this embracing of the freedom of speech, the embracing of these freedom of ideas, where these other people believe, no, we're going to have to be forced, or we need to be forced into seeing things and having the British ideological way inflicted upon us. Now, when you look at the difference between the ideology of Britain and the Glorious Bill of Rights and everything else, the only difference was that they believed in the right of, you know, these few rights that were ultimately put into the Glorious Bill of Rights, the right of, you know, representation for taxation. This was pretty small. In contrast today to the communists that are demanding the dismantling of our government and are actually exercising powers not granted in doing communist and socialistic programs, inflicting socialism and communism upon us by our own governments, i.e. our governors and state legislatures, as well as at times our presidents and congresses, have literally waged war against our Constitution. And we think it's okay. You see what I'm trying to create this correlation here. At what point do we start realizing these true enemies and what they're truly doing today? Because in contrast, what we're dealing with is so far worse than what they were dealing with their brethren who were British, you know, descent as well. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're putting up with way, way more than they were rebelling against.
Okay, so let's read this last one, because actually the last two, because there are two that were done really quickly, that were done in June 18th, and then to June 24th, and then the Declaration of Independence. So let's go ahead and dive into that.
Resolved that no man in these colonies charged with being a Tory or unfriendly to the cause of American liberty be injured in his person or property or in any matter whatever disturbed unless the proceeding against him be founded on an order of this Congress or the Assembly Convention, Council or Committee of Safety of the Colony or Committee of Inspection and Observation of the district wherein he resides, provided that this resolution shall not prevent the apprehending of any person found in the commission of some act destructive of American liberty or justly suspected of a design to commit such act and intending to escape, and bringing such person before proper authority for examination and trial.
Okay, so right here, it's identified of the Continental Congress being the judiciary, right? Because it says, unless they've been brought before us, right? So it has to be an order from their court. So this speaks to this concept of a magistrate body of government. Even though it's representative, all the functions of government that we look at today, executive, judiciary, and legislative, it's all kind of encompassed into this body. Now, the problem, again, they didn't get the power delegated to them, the true authority, under the Articles of Confederation. So there's no doubt in my mind there were states and or colonies at the time that were pushing back saying, oh, you know, hold on here, you don't have this authority. There's no doubt that Rhode Island was one of those, because Rhode Island actually had a navy. They were one of the few states that actually had a navy. And when they decided to create a navy, Rhode Island wasn't going to volunteer any of their navy. They withheld that. So as we go into the break, we'll come back and we'll read this last one. And this is literally just a week plus before the Declaration of Independence gets promulgated. So in other words, by this point in time, the committee to draft up the Declaration of Independence had already been formed. And by June 24th, they've already seen the rough draft and have edited it already. So we'll be right back after this short break. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so welcome back. And so, Sean, as we kind of see what was happening in Continental Congress, they had already gone through the data call. And if you're familiar with the Declaration of Independence, it was included in the declaration of how we petitioned you and petitioned you and petitioned you to no avail. I mean, you had ignored our cries and petitions, which was one of the justifications. I mean, so if you really look at what these men were doing in a very civil process, they were basically stating to the world, this is absolutely unacceptable tyranny, even based on our own, you know, not a constitution, because they didn't have a constitution. Their constitution was the Bill of Rights. In other words, King, you can do anything and everything you want to us as long as you don't do these things, which is why the U.S. Constitution did the exact opposite. The U.S. Constitution said you can only do these things. We don't need a Bill of Rights, which is a superior constitution. So anyway, so let's read and finish up this final Tory Act.
Resolved that all persons abiding within any of the United Colonies and deriving protection from the laws of the same owe allegiance to the said laws and are members of such colony, and that all persons passing through, visiting, or make a temporary stay in any of the said colonies, being entitled to the protection of the laws during the time of such passage, visitation, or temporary stay, owe during the same time allegiance thereto, that all persons members of or owing allegiance to any of the United Colonies as before described who shall levy war against any of the said colonies within the same or be adherent to the King of Great Britain or others the enemies of the said colonies or any of them within the same giving to him or them aid and comfort are guilty of treason against such colony, that it be recommended to the legislatures of the several United Colonies to pass laws for punishing in such manner as to them shall seem fit such persons before described, as shall be provably attainted of open deed by people of their condition of any of the treasons before described.
So, as we examine the Tory Acts, this was all prior to the Revolutionary War. Going into the Declaration of Independence and actually prosecuting or defending ourselves against this dictator, this crown, that said, we're not letting you free yourselves over our dead body. And so they sent troops. They sent Hessians. They sent more mercenaries and troops. They were filling up the colonies with more and more, and they were at a point where they were prosecuting a war that was far more expensive than anything that they had done that they wanted to tax us for. And so even up to this point, the king still was going to continue and continue and continue until we finally actually kicked their butt. And I believe it was Cromwell that we ended up defeating. But which caused the treaty and the end of the part one of the Revolutionary War. Because even though we have kind of proven that they can't stop us, they can't keep force us, you know, to be a part of their empire anymore, they still believed that they could do it. And they waited until 1812 to launch their second attack to say, we weren't done with you. This is why we haven't honored the treaty. And so we're bringing you back. And they actually really hurt us because we weren't expecting what they did in that surprise attack. They burnt down D.C., so forth and so on. But anyway, let's kind of walk through, you know, how this was happening by the Tory acts. We now go into this war. What we're going to do is we're going to back up now, and we're going to actually look at the Articles of Association, what it was, and then we're going to read their first petition to the king. Again, this is going back to the very first point in time, to letting the king know that we have organized to this point as a unified confederation. All of the colonies, 13 colonies, have now confederated and are now reaching out to you to say, stop this madness, give us representation. Now, they don't say give us representation. What they say in the Articles of Association is they're creating this confederation to basically push back because of these ills, because of what they're doing. These are the positions or the economic means that we're going to push back to hurt you because we believe we have these rights. So we organized in this, you know, this great manner of saying, you know what, you just can't push us around. It's not like we're just this little township. We're this large bodies of colonies that actually have a lot of people here. Anyway, so the next document we're going to go into, but Sean, anything to cover up to this point as we've kind of gone up to the Tory Acts?
No, sir.
Okay. So
I found it, I did find it kind of almost like it was very similar wording to the definition of treason in the Constitution that we just went over.
Yes, very similar. The interesting thing is that what they ended up doing, because these Tories that they had identified ended up getting sent away. In other words, they were all deported. Over 100,000 Tories lost their property and were basically expelled from the United States. Many went up to Canada, which is one of the reasons why Canada has kind of been, you know, haters and so forth, because a large mass went up there. Some went back to England. The most affluent went back to England, because they probably still had, you know, bloodlines and what have you with their own little castles, kingdoms, what have you. But nevertheless, as we lay this out and look at what they ended up doing, the question I have for you is this not precedence to literally start treating the Bill Gates and the Zuckerbergs and all of these large corporate hacks that are basically waging warfare against our rights, setting up these, I'll call them, these AI data centers, all the spying, everything that they're doing to us? Does this not give us the precedence to literally say, you don't have these resources, seize all their assets, seize all their resources, strip everything from them and put them on a boat, a slow boat, you know, with basic bread and water, and dump them off at whatever communist country that they feel fit? I mean, if Bill Gates wants to basically go to China now that he has nothing to offer them and see what kind of praise they're going to give him, that's fine. I mean, most people want to see people walk, you know, and dangle at the end of a rope. I believe what the framers did was the right thing. That the best justice is just getting them out of here, because the extraction of justice becomes literally, you know, this, well, you know, you killed them. That was just wrong. It was, you know, it's not like he, you know, the arguments come back and forth. You know, that was too excessive, what have you. Deportation is finite. It is ultimate, and stripping them of all their resources in that process, I believe, is the best way. Now, Britain, in the Treaty of Versailles, basically said, you need to pay us. And we kind of agreed that we would compensate them for that. At least that's what the emissaries basically agreed to. However, as soon as the treaty was initiated or was enacted upon, Britain instantly stopped honoring it by basically seizing ships and impressing. And even though maybe the king wanted to actually honor it, they didn't. We didn't honor the payment or anything else. So both sides of that original treaty, which is why it led to part two of the Revolutionary War. So anyway, at this point, let's crack open the Articles of Association so that we can dive into that and actually go through what actually was delegated to the Continental Congress. Because this is what really lays out what powers they were to have, right? Because they created this governing body or this council, Congress. What powers did they give them, right? Because as we look at our Constitution, we realize that Congress, the president, and the judiciary only have certain roles. So in other words, based on what they didn't get, we can see what they had to assume just to move forward, which was why they needed to create the Articles of Confederation to legitimize the powers of Continental Congress. So let's go ahead and start with the preamble.
We, His Majesty's most loyal subjects, the delegates of the several colonies of New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, the three lower counties of Newcastle, Kent, and Sussex on Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, deputed to represent them in a Continental Congress held in the city of Philadelphia on the fifth day of September, 1774. Avowing our allegiance to His Majesty, our affection and regard for our fellow subjects in Great Britain and elsewhere, affected with the deepest anxiety and most alarming apprehensions at those grievances and distresses with which His Majesty's American subjects are oppressed, and having taken under our most serious deliberation the state of the whole continent, find that the present unhappy situation of our affairs is occasioned by a ruinous system of colony administration adopted by the British ministry about the year 1763, evidently calculated for enslaving these colonies and with them the British Empire. In prosecution of which system, various acts of Parliament have been passed for raising a revenue in America, for depriving the American subjects in many instances of the constitutional trial by jury, exposing their lives to danger by directing a new and illegal trial beyond the seas for crimes alleged to have been committed in America, and in prosecution of the same system, several late, cruel, and oppressive acts have been passed respecting the town of Boston and Massachusetts Bay, and also an act for extending the province of Quebec so as to border on the western frontier of these colonies, establishing an arbitrary government therein and discouraging the settlement of British subjects in that wide extended country. Thus, by the influence of the civil principles and ancient prejudices, to dispose the inhabitants to act with hostility against the free Protestant colonies whenever a wicked ministry shall choose so to direct them.
Okay, so at this point you can kind of see how they were really concerned about these trial by jury and these things that they were being denied. This comes up when we actually start looking at the ratification debates, because the Constitution didn't give the federal government control or jurisdiction over common law. They only gave them jurisdiction over things arising under this Constitution, which basically meant that whoever was going to be prosecuted for the crimes, and there was literally only four crimes that they could actually prosecute. And so the execution, because the whole point as going through the ratification debates, They were making up crimes and actually providing these punishments of either hanging and or these this other just really bad incarcerations. I mean, both basically either putting people in harm's way to where they were going to die and just the most dire oppression. So as they started looking at this, this is one of the reasons why this very last line says, whatever a wicked ministry shall choose so to direct them. So we can see that as they started actually standing up on certain things, when you look at this document as well as the petition, and doesn't this start off as a petition for redress?
Absolutely.
And in this next line, it actually talks about obtaining redress at this next part. So when we look at the Articles Association and this very first petition, they were kind of doing the same thing. This one was more focused on their response, and the other one was more focused on, you know, we demand redress. But anyway, let's go ahead and keep going through this last paragraph, and then we can, if there's anything you want to expound upon, then if not, we can go into Article 1 and through the articles. So go ahead.
To obtain redress of these grievances, which threaten destruction to the lives, liberty, and property of His Majesty's subjects in North America, we are of opinion that a non-importation, non-consumption, and non-exportation agreement faithfully adhered to will prove the most speedy, effectual, and peaceable measure. And therefore, we do, for ourselves and the inhabitants of the several colonies whom we represent, firmly agree and associate under sacred ties of virtue, honor, and love of our country as follows.
Okay, so nowhere here did they say that they were going to take up arms. They were going to use any force at all with the existing governments and the king's agents in America. Not at all. It was all economic fight. It was just keeping things in the economic sense because they thought that hurting the king, because what the king was trying to do was he was trying to make taxes and put taxes on these very specific things. And they said, we're not going to consume that crap. We'd rather eat dirt than drink your tea, kind of thing. So let's go ahead and get into the Article 1.
Article 1, that from and after the first day of December next, we will not import into British America from Great Britain or Ireland any goods, wares, or merchandise whatsoever, or from any other place any such goods, wares, or merchandise as shall have been exported from Great Britain or Ireland. Nor will we, after that day, import any East India tea from any part of the world, nor any molasses, syrups, pinellas, coffee, or pimento from the British plantations or from Dominica, nor wines from Madeira or the Western Islands, nor foreign indigo.
Okay, so foreign indigo being a dye or something they use for coloring. But again, this is all economical. And they even point out that they're not going to do anything, import anything with the East India Trading Company. They've identified some of these companies by name. These companies were corporations that, guess what? The British Crown had created. Corporations that the British Crown created. Now, do you remember when we were going through the bank bill, where we actually pulled out in the arguments where Madison clearly stated and pointed out that in the convention, the idea of the federal government being able to create a charter and or corporations was addressed and it was rejected, that the federal government couldn't do that because of this kind of tyranny. They didn't want to give them any way they could amass power and start inflicting, you know, and enforcing laws because the West and East Indies Trading Company, I think the East were the worst, because they went through and enforced the tyranny of the king, killing people because they weren't getting paid what they were asking for. Oh, we want to renegotiate. As a matter of fact, that's what happened in China a century or so before that. Anyway, let's go into Article 2.
We would neither import nor purchase any slave imported after the first day of December next, after which time we will wholly discontinue the slave trade, and will neither be concerned in it ourselves, nor will we hire our vessels, nor sell our commodities or manufactures to those who are concerned in it.
So at this point in time, folks, the resolve of ending the slave trade was communicated, right?
But I thought we were founded by a bunch of white supremacists, GR.
Yeah, so, okay, but my point is the political correctness ended, or I should say, so America was really being threatened. And sometimes when people, you know, it's kind of like, I don't want to say simpleton Christian or what have you, you know, how they, you know, have you ever seen it where, you know, somebody says, you know, God's punishing me. And so they basically, oh, you know, God, please, if you just stop this, I will never do these things ever again. And then as soon as it stops, they go back to doing those things. It's kind of that, I see it that way with this, because America was, I mean, they were so resolved that they were going to end slavery and all of that. Again, remember that they were just bitten in the South with this uprising as well. Prior to, you know, the forming and all of that, the king had basically made it, you know, created this revolution, because as we started going down the path of resistance, he said, okay, well, let's see what happens down here in your plantations where you're very vulnerable, because you're spread yourself so thin that you can't, once if I give these guys guns, you can't stop them. And that's what ended up happening. They literally created this small little coup revolution. So the point is, I think, is as you look at this beginning, the South seemed to all concede that they needed to end the slave trade. But then when they realized that they just took on Britain, because there's no language in the Articles of Confederation regarding slavery, if I remember correctly. But after we won the war, then all of a sudden the South said, you know what, we're invincible, we're keeping slavery because we need it. We got to have it. You see my point?
Oh, yes, sir.
So in desperate times, they actually did. They put the right foot forward. They said, yeah, we need to get off this. We need to get off this train now. Anyway, so let's go ahead with Article 3.
Do you think that that was like I don't want to call it propaganda, but like promises, you know, making the people think that that's what was going to happen when they didn't really intend on doing it?
Well, so if you remember,
sound more virtuous.
Well, so actually the sentiments kind of changed quickly, because right. If you remember the Declaration of Independence, you know, the complaining or what Thomas Jefferson put in regarding slavery and how it was just this evil institution, the Southern states actually edited that out. You know, we're only talking about a year or so later with the Declaration of Independence from the Articles of Association, actually 2 years, about a year and a half. So the point is this, is that it didn't take long for them to kind of realize, we maybe not want to, you know, make such political hay on this. Because down the road, if we can keep slavery, we're going to want to keep slavery. And that's how it played out. So even though everybody was willing at this point, just because they saw this gloom and doom, when they realized, hey, you know what, we kind of got a good thing going here. We can probably do this. The tune changed more and more. And because in America, the slave trade or the slave franchise, everything else, you know, became the sucking hole of corruption. They started using their money and influence, because they had a lot of money and affluence, and they started using that and corrupting, the judiciary. And Hamilton went along with that, because if you look at the judges that Hamilton recommended for positions in the federal courts, the majority of them were Southern judges. So, anyway, let's go ahead and go through this next one.
Article 3, as a non-consumption agreement strictly adhered to, will be an effectual security for the observation of non-importation, we as above solemnly agree and associate that from this day we will not purchase or use any tea imported on account of the East India Company or any on which a duty bath been or shall be paid. And from and after the first day of March next, we will not purchase or use any East India tea whatever. Nor will we, nor shall any person for or under us, purchase or use any of those goods, wares, or merchandise we have agreed not to import. We shall know or have cause to suspect were imported after the first day of December, except such as come under the rules and directions of the 10th article hereafter mentioned.
Okay, so again, the labeling and or the calling out of the East India Company. Let's go ahead and read the next one.
Article 4. Uh-huh. The earnest desire we have not to injure our fellow subjects in Great Britain, Ireland, or the West Indies induces us to suspend a non-exportation until the 10th day of September 1775, at which time, if the said acts and parts of the acts of the British Parliament herein after mentioned are not repealed, we will not directly or indirectly export any merchandise or commodity whatsoever to Great Britain, Ireland, or the West Indies, except rice to Europe.
Okay, so the only thing that they were going to commit to exporting, allowing to leave their shore, was rice going to Europe. Okay, now Article 5.
Such as are merchants and use the British and Irish trade will give orders as soon as possible to their factors, agents, and correspondents in Great Britain and Ireland not to ship any goods to them on any pretense whatsoever, as they cannot be received in America. And if any merchant residing in Great Britain or Ireland shall directly or indirectly ship any goods, wares, or merchandise for America in order to break the said non-importation agreement, or in any manner contravene the same, on such unworthy conduct being well attested, it ought to be made public, and on the same being so done, we will not from thenceforth have any commercial connection with such merchant.
Okay, so at this point in time, we're out of time. We got about a minute. Anything you want to add? Because we'll pick it up from here on tomorrow. Anything?
No, we're good.
Okay, so clearly, everything is all about commerce. Everything is saying, we're going to hit you where we can hurt you. You need money because you got debtors calling on you? Then we're going to take any type of money you can make off of us away from you. There you go. And so this only incited the king to basically say, who do these people think they are? They think they can get away with this? I'm the king of the world. And, you know, the mightier they are, the mightier their fall. So, anyhow, if there's nothing else, what we'll do is if you cogitate or come up and ruminate with some things you want to point out after we've absorbed this and had time to kind of ruminate, the point is that we'll see if you want to have something to come up on. But if not, then we will just dive into the remaining parts, because right now we're only in Article 5 out of the total 14 articles. So, and, you know, we're almost halfway through this. But it's important so that you can actually see what our forefathers did in their very first protest. This was a very civil stand in demanding compliance to the law, which is they were setting the standard of how First Amendment petitions needed to be. So we'll be back. I'm J.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.